SF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 22nd, 2026. Well, wars and rumors of war, this is the stuff that makes presses spin and TV ratings soar. So why then are we seeing and hearing nothing about the most dire conflict in living memory from either corporate media, bound by law to maximize shareholder profit, or the CBC, whose stated mission promises Canadians in return for tax funding to inform, to reveal, to contribute to the understanding of issues of public interest? The civilian population of Palestine in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, are targeted by both the Israeli military apparatus, aided by Western nations, and a heavily armed settler occupation, aided by police and the IDF. Men, women, children, killed and maimed, imprisoned, thrown out of homes, and robbed of their livelihoods. All this every day as the global establishment, the legal and medical professional boards, universities, corporations, institutes, associations, and NGOs maintain a silent complicity, or worse. How is that not on every front page? How is it not the biggest bleeding, leading story of every TV broadcast? Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo is Director of Development for GLIA Equal Care and leads GLIA.org's Open Gaza Initiative Project. Dorothea is too a member of Eyewitness Gaza, a coalition of health professionals, aid workers, community leaders, and others calling out policymakers and the media here in Canada for their failures to oppose this 21st century Holocaust. More, she's a literal eyewitness to the Gaza genocide, now in the besieged enclave for the fourth time. Dorothea Gucciardo in the first half. And over the weekend, members of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network took to the streets to demand this country, Canada, withdraw from NATO and cancel the planned NATO war bank. Their call takes on added urgency as our international banker prime minister moves the economy towards a war footing, making perpetual war the key to an expanding financial future, or so Mark Carney and his liberals hope. But a growing number see their plans as less a road to prosperity than a daylight theft from the public purse in the service of private power, a certain path to moral and national bankruptcy. Dr. Tamara Lawrence is a fellow with the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute and member of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace. She's also served on the advisory committee of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and too contributes her knowledge and talents to World Beyond War and the No to NATO Network. She's too a renowned disruptor of Canada's public-facing servants of war. Tamara Lawrence and Choosing Peace Over War, Canada Over NATO in the second half. But first, Dorothea Gucciardo, from where these latest wars began and continue, Gaza. Dorothea, we're starting from the top again. You're in Gaza, and our communications have been spotty. That's not an entire surprise. You were saying that you're in the middle area. Can you tell us more about what you're seeing on the ground there now?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Yes, I'm in the middle area. I'm in a town called Deir al-Balah, which, relative to the rest of the Gaza Strip, it has experienced Israeli violence, but not to the levels that we've seen in the north, which has been completely decimated, or in the south, which in Rafah, which no longer exists. There are pockets in the middle area that have been relatively untouched, and I'm viewing them almost as evidence of a genocide of a Gaza that existed before the genocide. And so I visited some of these places. Like, there's a children's museum. It's in an old monastery. There's a youth center, both one held outside as a gardens and the one that has classes for students inside of a building. And these spaces are beautiful. They're beautifully maintained. They're run by incredibly dedicated volunteers and staff. And they're providing these glimpses of a Gaza that once was, and also of a Gaza that could be if it was just left alone, you know, that if it didn't have to survive under conditions of military blockade and occupation and genocide. And so I've been really thankful for these opportunities. But it's important to note that they are just glimpses, right? They're like passing references to a past, because the entirety of the Gaza Strip is completely completely transformed from what it ever was. And it's continuing to be transformed as the Israelis are pushing more and more toward the coast, where the population is being further and further squeezed, so that now Palestinians are living in about 30% of the entirety of the Gaza Strip.
Well, from the destruction that we see, when we do see it here, it seems utter. Is there hope then still of rehabilitation after this conflict is finished, after Israel leaves?
That's the key. The key is that you cannot have any kind of rehabilitation or rebuild within this existing system. It's just going to be a perpetual cycle of violence, and it's going to be targeted always toward the Palestinians. You know, they're doing the best that they can within the circumstances that we're in. The blockade is still very much strangling the population. There are very few trucks that are coming in. None of those trucks that are coming in are providing vital reconstruction materials like cement. Cement is not allowed in. And I would argue that the two things you need the most here in order for any kind of rehabilitation or reconstruction are cement and fuel. Fuel is coming in small quantities, not enough quantities to power generators, not enough quantities to ensure that the hospitals are running at full capacity, to ensure that desalination plants, at least the ones that haven't been bombed, are running at full capacity, that kitchens can run, that schools can run. Like, there's not enough fuel that's coming in. So the economy and the restructuring is either crippled or non-existent because we're lacking these two resources. But as I said, the Palestinians themselves are trying to make do with whatever materials that they have access to. I've noticed that nearly everything is considered something. You know, it's either being repaired so that its lifespan can be continued, or it's something that is being transformed into something else because the material that they need doesn't exist. It's okay for short term, I suppose, but this isn't any kind of standard of living that anyone should deem acceptable. What we need is a full opening of the borders and full access of supplies so that the system, the infrastructure, the people can rebuild.
Well, this is where GLIA was born. This is the métier of making things work, using, in a MacGyver sense, but also it expanded into manufacturing and 3D printing and so forth. Could you tell us a little bit about GLIA.org and what you're doing there with them?
Yeah, thank you for asking. We're doing a lot of really exciting work, I think. I would say we have two pillars at this point in the genocide. One is related to clinical services, which has been very new to us, but we are working closely with the Ministry of Health to provide wound care services at one of the hospitals here. The ministry has deemed wound care to be one of the vital services that's required, and I can see it. You know, I kind of understood it in concept, but I absolutely appreciated it when I saw it in person. Because we are still seeing mass casualty incidents, there, of course, is not a true ceasefire. We're seeing about 18 airstrikes a week, and then I don't even know how many people are getting shot by drones or the naval ships or snipers. But the number of mass casualty incidents has gone down. So what we're seeing in the hospitals are people who haven't had an opportunity to heal from wounds that they received a year ago. You know, one of the patients in our wound care service was shot trying to receive aid at one of those GHF sites from last summer, right? That militarized aid model that was supposed to replace the UN. He's still suffering from these injuries. There's at least 20,000 people around our hospital alone that are suffering from these wounds that can't heal because they haven't had the time or the resources to do so. And so while we do try to fix things, we're also trying to help fix this situation by providing the care that they haven't been able to receive. And the things that we're trying to fix are also related very much to wound care. You know, we were approached by MSF, for example, to help 3D print face, these, like, they're called burn masks. So for people who have suffered from burns, whether they were from an airstrike or perhaps a fire in a tent, for example, like a cooking fire, you can put this burn mask on someone and it can help the skin heal better. We were approached by a neurosurgeon similarly to help create molds of skulls because he had to perform craniectomies where they remove a part of the skull in order to relieve some pressure. but you have to be able to put that skull back, or you have to be able to put something back. But many of his patients, he operated on a year ago. You have to typically operate within 3 to 6 months to repair that hole, but he hasn't been able to. These patients haven't been able to receive this reconstructive surgery. And so he's doing it now, and we're trying to see if we can help 3D print the molds to make the plaster that he'll use to help replace that hole a little bit easier and a little bit more cosmetically appealing. And then not to mention, of course, the devices that we're helping to repair within the hospitals themselves. We don't have medical devices coming in. The Israeli military is not allowing them in. And so this really is a situation of, can we fix what we have and how can we do it? And sometimes it's a matter of 3D printing a brand new gear for a machine that is not working, replacing that gear, and then that machine comes back to life. And we've seen this with some infusion pumps, for example. So really, yeah, you're right. There's a bit of MacGyvering there that's happening, but there's also a strategy to it. You know, we're trying to work with the Ministry of Health, with the healthcare workers on the ground to build capacity, just as much as we're trying to provide immediate solutions, right? We still have this military entity that is in control of what can come in, how much can come in. And it's not enough. You know, it's part of the overall policy of genocide. Keep the population sustained just enough or just slightly under, right? There's perpetual suffering here. That's intentional. And I think, you know, what the Zionists have really been successful at doing is normalizing Palestinian suffering. They're normalizing it. We've seen this suffering nonstop for 3 years, and people become desensitized to it. We can't. This is not okay. This is not normal. No one should be living like this. And all of it is intentional. All of this could be stopped through political decision making. And I think we really have to keep reminding ourselves of that, that it really is that simple, and that there are things that we can be doing to combat against it, because the people, the Palestinians in Palestine, they have to fight the daily struggle. But us on the outside, there are things that we can be doing to be putting pressure on our governments to change these circumstances. It's untenable, it's unjust, and it has to come to an end.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo. She's Director of Development for GLIA Equal Care and leads GLIA.org's Open Gaza Initiative Project. She is too a member of Eyewitness Gaza, a coalition of health professionals, aid workers, and community leaders calling out policymakers in the media here in Canada for their failure to make themselves present in what is the 21st century Holocaust, by some accounts, genocide by all measures. Dorothea, the last time we spoke in November, you had a Herculean effort to get back into Gaza. You ended up launching a lawsuit within Israel against the government. How was your entry this time? Did you have to jump those kinds of hurdles again?
I sure did. I did. Yeah. In fact, so I exited in November and I attempted to re-enter in December and I was denied again. So I once again filed another court appeal. Interestingly, in comparison to the last time when they said, okay, we'll let her in on condition that she is interrogated, this time they said, well, she can apply again. And it's like it's a game for them. You know, there's no rationale, there's no standard operating procedure, there's nothing predictable to hold on to. You're constantly on edge wondering if you're going to be able to get in or not. So I applied, I saw that I was accepted, I was surprised, but of course I was elated because I wanted to come back to see my colleagues and to continue doing this great work. But even during the entire rotation in the back of my mind, I'm like, are they going to arrest me? Are they going to interrogate me? You don't know. And that really also is part of it, too. The entire process is meant to be destabilizing. They don't want people here in support in any capacity of Palestine or of Palestinians. And so they make any effort that you take to do so difficult. But that's where persistence is key. You know, if we gave up at the first rejection, then we wouldn't have gotten as far as we have. So it's important, I think, to keep trying, not just for people like me who have access and who can come here and do work on the ground, but also for people on the outside to remember that there's always something that we can be doing to push back.
what can we be doing to, I mean, the issue is largely forgotten here, especially because of the media. Most people think, oh, well, there's a ceasefire and now there's Iran to think about, or other, you know, Ukraine, or any other number of disasters and issues that vie for people's attention. Gaza has been slid very far in the background, this 33 or 4 months or something into this genocide. But what can we do here to find out, to get ourselves educated and involved?
Yeah, well, I think that there's an important distinction to be made between it falling off the falling from the headlines and people not thinking about it. I do think that there are massive people that still understand what's happening, and they have watched this genocide unfold, and they can't forget. They can't forget the images that they've seen, the images of people being literally blown apart, crying for their loved ones, of being starved, of being shot at while trying to get aid. You can't forget these things. There are a level of depravity and violence that is not easily forgettable. And they also demonstrated to people the lies and the propaganda that they've been told their whole lives about why things are the way they are. And they've deemed these things unacceptable. So I think a lot of people haven't forgotten. The media and the government, it's in their interest to not share the stories because they want us to forget. So I think one of the very first things we can do is to continue talking about it, because the more that we talk about it, the more that people will feel comfortable talking about it, and we can keep the momentum going. That's really up to us. We can't rely on the mainstream media to do that for us. And so thinking about how we can create publicity campaigns, thinking about, encouraging more public conversations, more protests, more letters to our MPs, for example. And the demands that we can be making are varied and just, you know, anything from demanding that the government stops producing, procuring, providing anything related to military equipment that the Israeli government can use in its genocide against Palestinians. We can demand that the Israeli ambassador be banned, you know, from Canada. They can remove that post. They can recognize this genocide for what it is. And that in itself is a victory, you know, forcing the Canadian government to even call it a genocide, because it hasn't. The moment that it calls it a genocide, it has to take certain legal actions. And so, you know, pushing for these things is incredibly important, but so too are things that we can do with our provincial governments. I'm not so sure what the situation is in British Columbia, but in Ontario, for example, there are many sales of stolen Palestinian land that is happening throughout the province. The provincial government doesn't need to allow that. You know, Ontarians can tell the premier that this is unacceptable, that they have to abide by international law. We're reminding the government of the things that they're already obligated to do. And in mass, in large numbers, they will listen. They have to listen. And so it's really up to us to keep the momentum going, because we cannot rely on these talking heads to do it. We have to do it.
Yeah, well, sadly, British Columbia is not much of a friend, at least the government here is not much of a friend of the Palestinians or the Gaza issue right now. You are also a member of Doctors Against Genocide. Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, his name is up again. He's in dire condition. Do you want to remind people who Abu Safia is and what his condition is at the moment?
Yeah, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia is a pediatrician who was at Kamal Adwan Hospital in the north of Gaza, which was besieged by Israeli forces. He remained in the hospital until patients and staff were evacuated, and then presented himself to the Israelis, knowing and understanding that he was going to be arrested. And that, I mean, to be clear, was an act of bravery. But Dr. Abu Safia is one of 83 Palestinian healthcare workers that are currently still in detention, others, some of whom have actually been in detention for over 800 days without charge. They're being held hostage. They're being beaten. They're being starved. They're being psychologically tortured, all for being healthcare workers. That's it. For the decision to try to save lives, they are being punished. And so there are multiple campaigns with Dr. Abu Safia's story leading these campaigns. But it's important to remember that there are other Palestinian healthcare workers and regular civilians who have been kidnapped and brought into Israeli prisons, also being held without charge. And the Canadian government has an obligation to do something about that, especially in reference to the healthcare workers. They have obligations under the Geneva Conventions to protect healthcare workers from this type of abuse, and they're failing to do so. The reality is that the genocide in Gaza is multifaceted. It's daily. It's happening in the soil because of the contamination. It's happening with the lack of resources that are coming in, whether it's food or shelter supplies, infrastructural supplies. Students, you know, children haven't been in school for almost 3 years. That's part of the genocide. Dr. Abu Sufia being imprisoned, these other healthcare workers being imprisoned, that is part of the genocide. This is a systematic attempt to make life in Palestine unbearable. So it's a big fight. It's a big fight, but there are multiple campaigns to support his release and also the release of other political prisoners.
Yeah, people may remember the an iconic photograph of Dr. Abu Sufia walking out of the besieged hospital across a rubble field alone in his wearing his lab coat towards an Israeli tank. That was December 27th, 2024. His days in detention since
over a year then.
570 days. And his lawyer reported about a week and a half ago, after visiting him on July the 2nd, his lawyer told the press that his client was covered in bruises and torture marks across his body. And he describes him as being barely recognizable. And Dr. Mm-hmm. Abu Sufia said to him, he reports, "This is the last time you'll see me. They brought me here to kill me." And what pictures have been released of him, he is barely recognizable to the man who was taken prisoner back in December of 2024.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to contextualize this just a little bit more, because I want to point out that the hostage taking of Palestinians in Gaza is so routine, even prior to this act of genocide, that there was built an entire compound. I don't remember the Arabic name, but translated to English is freed captive city. These were multiple buildings constructed to support the released hostages and their families. That's how routine it was for Palestinians in Gaza to be taken hostage. And during this genocide, of course, the entire compound has been destroyed.
All health workers murdered at home using these various technologies. The first responders murdered as well. It has been systematic, and we've seen it repeated in Lebanon and now beginning in Iran as well.
Yes, we have. And I think that's another important takeaway here, because what is being allowed to happen in the Gaza Strip will absolutely be repeated elsewhere. And for those people who need to feel like it's more personal to them, even the technology of drones, you know, the use of drones to surveil the population is absolutely something that we can all anticipate seeing on our streets at public events. I mean, we're already seeing it to some extent. It's not that much of a leap for those drones to then be weaponized. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there are very personal reasons to also be offended by what's happening here and to be speaking out against it, because you really have to ask yourself, for everything you're hearing about Palestine, is that the type of life that you want to see repeated elsewhere? Is that the type of life you want to see coming to your own backyard?
Always, because it will. Comes home. It always comes home. Empire always comes home. You know, in the weekly marches that are still held here in Victoria on Saturdays, the police, about a month and a half or 2 months ago, stopped accompanying the marchers. So the police disappeared, but lo and behold, there were drones up above watching. And weapons are not just bullets. I mean, they're not just guns and bullets. It's information as well. And you know, who knows what they're gathering in that regard. When you mentioned that, you know, do we want this coming home, and how we are learning to accept more and more the depravities that are going on somewhere over there, it reminds me of the BC author J.B. McKinnon writing about something called baseline shift. He was talking about it in the context of the wildlife, and how one generation is used to seeing a huge proliferation of wildlife, and the next generation, when they see half of that, they regard that as normal, and this is a shift of baseline. But this also happens with our morality. And we're seeing a baseline shift. And as you say, people hardly pay attention because it's been so ubiquitous that we can't hold all this outrage. We can't witness the depravity without protecting ourselves. And so we become largely inured to it. And so it doesn't just go away or it doesn't stay at that level. It increases naturally and spreads out. And it will spread out all the way back here, and we're seeing it already. What we're losing here is more than Gaza and Palestine struggle. It is our humanity, in my view.
Yeah, I can understand why you feel that way. Absolutely. And it certainly feels that way for me sometimes, too. But I also recognize that, you know, whereas Palestinians don't have a choice, we do. You know, they don't have a choice but to endure these conditions. We do. We still have choices that we can be making, and we can either be leaning into these feelings of helplessness or hopelessness, or feeling like there's very little that me as an individual person can do. That's a choice that you're making. We can choose the other path too. You know, we don't have to let the despondency guide us. We can choose to be following our sense of justice, our sense of collective responsibility, our sense of accountability, and understand that that's not going to be comfortable. We don't have to accept a new baseline that is so vicious and violent. We can accept a baseline that has more justice for people throughout the world, and we can start with Palestine, because this is where they're bearing the brunt of empire's evil and empire's violence. And it's everywhere. It's not just in the airstrikes that are still happening weekly. You see it, you know, it's embedded in the infrastructure. You are constantly reminded. So earlier when I said that Palestinians are living in 30% of the Gaza Strip, well, guess what? That means the rest of it is being occupied by Israel. And they are continuously pushing everybody towards the coast, so much that even along a pier here in the southern part of Gaza, in Han Yunus, there are tents along the pier, almost as if they're literally being pushed over the edge, mm-hmm. you know? And wherever you are now in Gaza, you can see the berms. You can see the evidence of the Israelis. You can see these communication towers that they've erected. And people talk about how there are snipers on the berms, and people are getting shot at because they can, from those berms, shoot all the way to the coast. So it's a different type of surveillance than we had before, when the buildings at least provided some measure of privacy between Israel and Palestinians in Gaza. They're completely exposed now. And so the impression that I get is most people are walking around with a feeling of trepidation, because even though we're calling it a ceasefire, and even though the levels of violence have decreased, it's still there. You can see it on the naval ships that are shooting at the fishermen. You can hear the drones in the sky. You see the effects of, or are experiencing, the airstrikes. You have these berms. You have people getting shot. It's constant. And so the situation, I think, for most people is incredibly, incredibly difficult. It's incredibly challenging. And on top of that violence, they lack the resources that they need in order to live sustained and fulfilled lives. As I said earlier, it's not tenable, Chris, and really, they don't have a choice but to keep going and to keep focusing on daily subsistence. But we have a choice to keep looking and to keep talking and to keep acting and reminding ourselves and our governments that this is unacceptable for anyone.
Well, yes, write your MPs, by all means. Write your newspaper editorial board. Go to glia.org. That's glia.org. Eyewitness Gaza, Doctors Against Genocide. Remember Dr. Hussam Abu Safia and his plight. Write a note to your MP about that. Dorothea, we're fast out of time. Thanks a lot for coming on again. You're a hero and an example to all. And I do look forward to your safe return and our next conversation.
Thank you so much, Chris. You are too kind. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, of course. My next guest is Tamara Lawrence. We're going to talk about the militarization, the accelerating militarization of this country, Canada, after the break. Thanks again, Dorothea.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.
A world war is on, started by the USA.